You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a special exhibit of artwork from none other than Dr. Seuss will be on display this weekend in Whitefish Bay. We'll find out more coming up.
First, the State Assembly is debating the full state budget today after it passed the legislature's budget committee on a party line vote last week. There's a little conflict brewing right now between Governor Scott Walker, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, and Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald over the end of the budget.
Sean Johnson is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. He joins us now from the state capitol. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
Well, how is the budget debate going at this point?
To be expected. I mean, Democrats who are in the minority in the Assembly have offered a lot of amendments so far. Republicans have shot them all down. It's kind of the way it goes when there's a budget debate. The minority party is there to kind of make their case on why budget is bad and knowing procedurally they're not going to win.
Are Republicans in the Assembly expected to change much from where it is now?
Yeah, that's kind of the outstanding question that we have here right now, because we know that yesterday, Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald said he did not have the 17 votes he needed to pass this bill out of the Senate, and he wants to take it up on Friday. So if he's talking about making changes to the budget, Republicans would want to get those into the bill that passes the Assembly tonight. So then it becomes a matter of, like, how big is too big of a change? And you heard Assembly Speaker Robin Voss say today, he's open to some technical changes, but he's not going to make wholesale changes. And he said, his words were that he wasn't going to be held hostage by, you know, one member of the Senate who didn't get one thing that they wanted put in the budget. And he's pushing back there against a handful of conservatives in the Senate who have said they're not yet ready to support this budget.
Now, what kind of items are those Senate Republican conservatives looking for before they're going to give the thumbs up to the budget as it stands?
A couple of things we've heard from them, and this was reported first by the Journal Sentinel yesterday. One is they want this big sweeping DOT bill included in some way in the budget. And essentially what the bill would do, they call it the DOT reform bill, but it would restrict the ability of the Department of Transportation to spend money, because this is a group of Republican senators who think the DOT spends too much. They also want to move up the starting date for Wisconsin's repeal of the state prevailing wage law, which is essentially a base wage that the state pays on, or that has to be paid, excuse me, on state construction projects. They want to move that up to January 1st. As it stands right now, it's scheduled to be phased out if this budget passes, which, you know, we expect it will. It's scheduled to be phased out on September of 2018.
Now, Republicans in the Assembly have been pushing for more road funding. Are they buying into this idea of this law that would limit the DOT's ability to spend money?
Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who's been probably the most outspoken advocate for finding some kind of a revenue for roads and saying we need to have a long-term solution for transportation funding, is saying essentially that there are already a number of big DOT reforms in this budget, but he thinks that it has to be a two-part equation. You have to reform the DOT. You have to find some kind of long-term revenue source to pay for roads. This budget does not have that. And he actually said, you know, I'll accept the blame for that. We didn't get to where we needed to on that. And that is a problem that Democrats say is just going to be worse 2 years from now because the state's roads are already deteriorating. This budget just doesn't have enough money for roads to reverse that trend.
Is it possible the Assembly passes something close to what it looks like now? The Senate passes something different? And then what?
So if they do that, then things get interesting, because if the Senate's in on Friday, the Assembly's not planning on being back next week or in October, essentially somebody has to give, because if they let this budget drag on to October, which I think, you know, seems unlikely, that would mean that suddenly you're creating real issues for school districts because they don't know how much money they're going to get from the state. You're going to create more delays for road projects because they need this money. They need state money. So, yeah, we have the situation in Wisconsin where we don't have a government shutdown when we have a late budget, as we do now. It's more than 2 months late. But as you start to creep toward October, things get serious.
Talking to WPR Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnston about the latest from the state capitol. Moving on from the budget, Sean, the other big ticket item has been the Foxconn incentive package. Passed yesterday, this $3 billion incentive package in the state Senate. Was this a party line vote for the most part?
It was not a strict party line vote, mostly party lines, but you did have a couple lawmakers break ranks there. On the side voting for the bill, the 20 senators who voted for it, you had one Democrat, that's Democratic Senator Robert Wirch of Kenosha. He described himself as a third-generation factory worker who lost his job when his factory closed. He said those jobs were shipped over to China, and he wanted to try to get some of that, those jobs and that money back to Wisconsin.
And I had to vote to get some of that Far East money coming into our area to create manufacturing jobs. Manufacturing jobs are the best jobs.
Oh,
go ahead, Sean.
He essentially said that this wasn't the best deal. He was actually making quite a bit of noise about this ahead of the vote about how many problems it had, but it was the deal on the table. He is a senator from Kenosha, which is near where this plant we expect will likely be.
And then there was a crossover voting against it on the Republican side.
Yes, Green Bay Republican Senator Robert Coles, who after the vote said there was just too much uncertainty with this bill in terms of how much it's going to cost the state. I mean, it's $2.85 billion worth of refundable tax credits, meaning the state, if Foxconn meets all of its job metrics and it builds this plant, the state will be essentially cutting a check to Foxconn for $2.85 billion out of the general fund, which is where we pay for schools, healthcare, prisons. So that was an issue for Coles. He also didn't like the way that it leaves a lot of the the details up to the contract, which is being negotiated by the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, which has come under pretty heavy scrutiny by the Legislative Audit Bureau, and Senator Coles chairs the audit committee, so he's had plenty of time to review that criticism. But Senator Cole said it really boiled down to that funding and the uncertainty of whether that money's going to be there in the future.
It's my judgment that to put that much money on the line going forward and not knowing for sure whether we could make this thing balance out in our overall budget going forward, that's troubling to me.
And we saw an amendment process. Democrats tried to introduce a lot of amendments to the bill. As you mentioned, they did with the budget in the assembly. What happened?
Shot down. Every Democratic amendment was shot down. You did have a couple of Senate Republican amendments that were adopted. One would require the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation to have, put some job metrics as a requirement of their contract. It didn't say what those job metrics would have to be. So, there's all sorts of wiggle room there. I mean, hypothetically, the amendment, it does effectively nothing. It would be in WEDIC's best interest to put kind of job requirements in there. But there's nothing in this bill that exactly requires them to hit a certain number. There's another amendment that touched on something they added to the bill this week that we've talked about. They added this provision to the bill that would let or that would have previously had any cases involving Foxconn that are decided by a lower court judge, a circuit court judge, be appealed automatically directly to the state Supreme Court. This changed that a little bit. It would now, let those cases run through the regular appeals court system, although there would be the opportunity for an expedited appeal. But what the amendment left is that anytime there's a case involving Foxconn decided by a lower court, as soon as that case is appealed, it would be stayed or it would be temporarily blocked. So, for example, if there was a circuit court judge who issued a decision that went against Foxconn's lawyers could appeal. that appeal would automatically trigger a stay, meaning that lower court ruling would be blocked.
And then briefly, as we wrap up, Sean, this passed the Senate. The Assembly had passed a version of this bill. What's next?
The Assembly has to sign off on those final changes, and they've given every indication that they will do that. And once they do that, it's going to head to Governor Scott Walker for a signature, and it's pretty close to the deal that he negotiated with Foxconn, so he's likely going to sign it.
Sean, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief, looking at the big news from the state Senate on Foxconn and the state assembly on the budget.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
There are certain markers of the changing season. The first crocus in the spring, the first fall apple. Poet Catherine Jago tells us what says September to her.
It is homecoming season, Iron Man season, wasp and Concord grape season. It is seedhead season for turkey foot and little blue stem, season of dying black-eyed Susans, katydid season to rasp like hooligans with wooden rattles. It is gourd and beet season, hip and haw, hickory and walnut, muskmelon and mushroom. Starling season to mill in the burning bush, swallows to whitter on telephone wires. Season of rot and wither and drop, of topple and windfall, of riot and wishbones, of drab and flame. Season of apples and honey, of awe and atonement, of sunwane and night spill, of last times. It is squirreling season, season of grubs and peeling and gales, of canker and worm, of frilled purple kale, of boarding up and closing down, of silent summer houses, of storm windows and choked gutters, screen storing, rakes and piles. Season of soups and cider, of NyQuil, of fleece and fingerless gloves. Season of disguises, season of dread, decay, decline, of ripe and relinquish, of scour and rage, of hog fattening, of falling silent, turning in, of closing doors, of knuckles, of ebb and resignation. It is red osier dogwood fruiting season. It is the season of striped woolly bears on roads. It is aster and clotted snake root floweret season, season of milkweed glistening, season of split pods, of muskrat prints paddled from mire to boardwalk through the cattails, of cranberries and corn mazes, of school buses, of whetting, of whistle blasts on fields and chants and teams drilling, of stadiums roaring like rising jets, like the sound of a distant, deep-throated sea.
Catherine Jago is a translator and poet. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now fans of books like The Cat in the Hat or The Lorax will have a chance to see a special exhibit of paintings and drawings this weekend from the late late Theodore Seuss Geisel, better known as Dr. Seuss.
Some of the artwork will be familiar, but people will also get a chance to see pieces that were only released after Geisel's death in 1991. It'll be on display this week at Gallery 505 in Whitefish Bay.
Valerie Jackson is with us now. She's the curator of the exhibit and an expert in Dr. Seuss artwork. She's the owner of the Ann Jackson Gallery in Atlanta. Valerie, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Well, Valerie, tell us, if you would, a bit about this exhibit. What's in it?
Well, this is a very exciting collection, and we're very pleased to bring it to Whitefish Bay, Milwaukee area. We actually have about 70 years of Dr. Seuss's genius. That includes the book illustrations that we're all familiar with, It's also his secret paintings that he did at night. Some call them midnight paintings. He did these before the, most of them before the books were written. And then as he was writing the books, he painted for stress relief, these particular images. And he never showed them to anybody, and he never sold them. They were very private. And then we also have a collection of some of his political cartoons. He actually had over 400 published cartoons in his lifetime. And then another exciting facet to his work is the unorthodox taxidermies that he did in the 30s. And at that time, his father was the superintendent of the zoo in Massachusetts, Springfield, Massachusetts, where he grew up. So his dad would send him parts of the animals when they died, and he got out his plaster and he brought them back to life with these wonderful, whimsical creations.
So are the parts of the animals actually inside of the plaster, or did he just use
them
for inspiration?
They are not. Well, what he did was he took the actual animal parts and then got his plaster out and made an actual sculpture. So since he never wanted his original sold, he wanted to be published so people could afford them. So they made a mold of the originals out of resin, and then each one is hand-painted exactly like the original that is still in their home.
You said some of these are called, you think of them as nighttime paintings, and they were ones he didn't want really shown until after he had passed on. Why is that? When you look at these, do you see why that was?
He was just a very private man, and he did these just for fun. He never sold them. He never wanted to sell them. Even his friends never really knew what he had done. And as he got older and towards the end of his life, he wanted the world to see what he had done over this 70-year period. But he didn't want to be alive when it happened. And he was just he was not a public person. He was a private man. He didn't like the spotlight. He didn't do these to make money. He just got joy out of them. So he wanted them to be shared by the world. He wanted them to be affordable for people to purchase. So he wanted them done in limited editions. So these are pieces that have been reproduced from the originals, which he hand-signed all of his originals. So when the pieces are printed or reproduced, the signature was also printed. And then they're hand-numbered through the publishing company that his wife, Audrey, and him authorized to hire to be the publishers of this collection.
So why are we seeing the reproductions? Are they just too precious to send on tour?
Well, the originals are archived. Most of them are in archives. They lived in La Jolla, California, and a lot of them are still in their home. He was a big kind of a hoarder. He had art stuck on the walls, under the beds. He built secret rooms in the house.
Wow.
That, when he opened up, were filled with these secrets of the deep sculptures. And then the University of San Diego, which is right there in La Jolla, built a library to house his work in. So a lot of pieces are archived there in drawers and in vaults. And they only bring them out at special times of the year. So right now, you can't really publicly see his work in its entirety. You can see the published pieces, but the collection is still growing because if you think about it, this man illustrated every page in 42 of his books and painted his own private works and had over 400 published political cartoons done. And he did magazine covers and calendar covers. So he had a massive collection of his own art. And so just 140 or so have been published so far. But the collection is going to continue to grow.
Now, you're a Dr. Seuss expert, and unlike you, I've only seen probably what's been published. I've read his books to my kids, and I've seen some cartoons. For someone like you who's seen this exhibit and has seen some of the lesser-known works that he kind of wanted to keep secret, do you now understand his work and maybe his mind, too, in a way that you didn't understand it before you saw all
well,
these pieces?
Well, I tell you what. I mean, I've been doing this since the first day it was published. We were one of the very few galleries chosen to even carry it. And we only started with 10 pieces. And I have been learning about him on a daily basis for over 20 years. And I've had the opportunity to meet his wife, Audrey, to go out to San Diego to the archives where they opened up for us to actually go in and see, like, his notebooks that he kept in college, to see the original sculpture sitting there, to see just the inside world of Dr. Seuss's mind. And it's been such a treasure and such a pleasure learning about Dr. Seuss and following him and trying to get to understand him more every day. So you see a lot of his insight starting in the late 20s. The late 20s and 30s, he was actually in advertising. He did a lot of marketing for Standard Oil Company. He did marketing for Flit, the bug spray, which was also a Standard Oil product. So you see his amazing cartoons, and a lot of them were college-related. A lot of them had to do with Prohibition, because when he was growing up, his family had a big brewery and did very well with it. And when Prohibition came, they lost everything. And so he likes to refer to a lot of that in his work. And he was a big, he was big in political cartoons with World War II. He worked with Frank Capra, who was a famous director back in the 30s and 40s. He actually went into enemy lines with Frank to do documentaries for the Army.
That's incredible. So there's such a body of richness there with this work. And as we wrap up, Valerie, why do you think that his work has stood the test of time?
Because it speaks to everybody. It's his insight and how he thinks. It's the way he makes his words, the way he wrote his books. It just affects every age group from 100 years old to 1 year old. And he will stick with us through time in his movies, in his books, just in his political thoughts and feelings. He was an amazing man that brought a lot to us in this country, for sure. But he's also very popular all over the world, as we all know.
Well, sounds like an incredible opportunity to see some of his work. Valerie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Veronica. It's been a pleasure.
Valerie Jackson is a curator and a Dr. Seuss art expert, and she joined us to talk about a new exhibit of artwork from Dr. Seuss that's on display this week at Gallery 505 in Whitefish Bay.
Now, a growing number of teachers are becoming brand ambassadors for the technology they use in their classrooms. Teachers who have a big following on social media are being courted by companies like Apple, Google, and Microsoft. You might have seen this recent TV ad featuring a New Jersey teacher promoting Windows 10 and its digital pen.
I can actually see my lines when I'm shading in. I can change the weight, drawing directly on my screen. I couldn't do this on my Mac. All of my kids are performers, too. And I'm trying to bring the best performance out of them that I can.
Corporate influence on teachers is raising concerns about a potential conflict of interest. Natasha Singer recently wrote about this as part of a series on how the tech industry is influencing public schools. She's a technology reporter for the New York Times business section. Natasha, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So on a basic level, tell us what are teacher brand ambassadors? What does that mean?
So there's two things going on. One is that there are a number of teachers who are becoming brands in their own right by, you know, as you said, being on Twitter, speaking at conferences. And when they get to a certain level, they're courted by tech companies to represent the company's brands. And these ambassador programs, we found that several dozen startups have these programs. And they basically ask teachers to use certain products, whether it's like a math app or a 3D printer in their classroom, and to give the companies feedback about how to improve the product. And then also they engage the teachers to promote the app or the 3D printer, to spread the word to their colleagues on social media, to blog about it, and to go to these huge national conferences attended by tens of thousands of teachers and give presentations about what's so great about these products.
Is this the kind of thing where the teacher enters into a contract with the tech company agreeing to promote them?
Many companies have actual contracts, and the teachers are signing things like non-disclosure agreements, non-compete clauses, and their formal arrangements like you will write a blog post every other month, you will shoot a 4-minute video about how you use our product in your classroom and post it on our YouTube channel, you will give at least 3 talks per year about our product. And one of the concerns is whether tech companies are, in fact, taking advantage of teachers, because some of these clauses, we found one company that had a clause in their contract that said if anything goes wrong and we get sued, you, the teacher, are financially liable.
And so the teachers themselves who are engaging in this new relationship, new kind of relationship with tech companies, what do they say about why they do it and why it helps their kids?
I think there are all kinds of reasons. One is that, you know, we know that many teachers right now feel constrained. There are all these Common Core state standards they have to teach to students. There are all these standardized tests they have to give to students. And this is offering them the opportunity to, like, be creative, to give companies feedback. And, like, tech companies are the darlings of the United States right now. So your school may not want to know what you think, but a tech company in Silicon Valley wants to know what you think about their product, and they're going to listen to you and maybe change that classroom product to make it better. That's kind of a good feeling for teachers. And they also said that in exchange, they often get free, you know, $3,000 smart boards for their classroom, or $1,200 3D printers, or they get access to premium versions of these classroom apps. And they say that their schools couldn't afford that otherwise. So they feel like they are giving something back, getting something for their students, and they feel that there's a measure of altruism in it.
Right, and you do write about how teachers today often have to spend hundreds of dollars on buying supplies for their own classrooms. Many school districts across the country are strapped for funding right now, with state budgets being on rocky territory. So do you think that makes teachers, I mean, maybe not vulnerable, but maybe more interested in something like this than they would have been at a different time?
Look, I think that it's easy to understand why teachers would accept free classroom products from tech companies, right? Teachers want all the supplies they can get, and you know, the motivation is clear. The issue is, though, you know, you are a public school teacher, which is a civil servant, contracting with a private company to use that company's product in a public school classroom. And, like, if you think about it in a different way, let's say Google has some new social network for work, right? And Google reaches out to Facebook employees and says, hey, Facebook employees, can you test our new office social network at your office? Right? You could not imagine that happening. But this, you know, in a sense, a school is a nonprofit company, and the teachers are doing something in the classroom, and the classroom time is paid for by the school. So in a sense, like, taxpayers are subsidizing millions of dollars worth of free product testing and promotion for these companies.
Did the school districts that you spoke to have any concerns about this, or had anyone kind of thrown down a flag and said maybe this is a line that's being crossed?
So some of the administrators I spoke to said, you know, we are delighted to get all the free tech we can, and some of these programs come with free training for the teachers on these products, and then the teachers can come back and teach other teachers. And so they were happy about that part. Some did not know the obligations the teachers were taking on. They didn't know that teachers were signing these contracts. And in many school districts, teachers aren't allowed to sign contracts with private companies concerning what they do in the classroom. And then there were folks I interviewed who said, you know, what is the fact that teachers are being compensated? Because teachers are getting free $3,000 products, free $120 products. In some cases, some tech companies are giving them gift cards. In other cases, tech companies are flying them and putting them up in hotels to give talks about their products. Like, what is the impact of that on the teachers' choices? And so one school administrator said to me, like, if there are two, say, student online portfolios, and vendor A is giving swag and vendor B is not, is it possible that teacher is choosing vendor A's products because it came with swag, even though it's not the best fit for the classroom? So one of the questions is, how is this influencing the tools that are being used with students in public schools?
We're talking to Natasha Singer right now, technology reporter for the New York Times business section. She's been writing about how the tech industry is potentially influencing public school education. This is part of a series called Education Disrupted, and looking about whether a teacher might be influenced to bring in a particular bit of technology to the classroom because they had some free giveaways from the tech company itself. You know, that has some parallels that come up to the pharmaceutical industry, where physicians might be plied with meals or getaways and that kind of thing. And that studies have shown that after that happens, even one maybe small thing like a meal, that they're more likely then to dispense that medication to their patients. Is there a parallel here between the pharmaceutical industry and what's happening right now with technology and teachers?
These brand ambassador programs among teachers do seem very similar to the programs that drug companies set up to get top doctors to influence their peers. And as you pointed out, studies have shown that giving a doctor one free meal, and even a meal less than $20, has an effect of influencing the doctor to prescribe the medicine from the company they got the free meal from compared to other medicines. And if you think that, like, some doctors are earning several hundred thousand dollars or more per year, and a lunch of $20 is going to influence them, it raises questions about how these same kind of practices are influencing teachers.
And you wrote specifically about a third grade teacher in North Dakota. Her name is Kayla Delzer, who goes on speaking tours, and she promotes her teaching brand, which is a pretty big brand at this point. And every day her students tweet and post to Instagram from a classroom account. And here's what she had to say about that in a speech last year at Twitter headquarters.
When I finally got that Twitter account and I handed it over to them, suddenly they saw that the world is a lot bigger than Beaver River Falls, Minnesota, or it's a lot bigger than Fargo, North Dakota. Now I teach in Mapleton, where I have 15 third graders, and the world is bigger than Mapleton. It's a lot bigger than Mapleton. So my kids are really able to start building their digital footprint, looking at our classroom brand, all sorts of things like that. It was real.
Can you talk a little bit about Kayla Delzer speaking there at Twitter headquarters? Her case is, it's a complex one. On the one hand, she really seems to believe, and, you know, maybe the case, that this is benefiting her kids and helping pollinate good ideas in education. On the other hand, you write about an instance where she goes into an agreement with a clothing store and gets her clothes for free. It gets a little sticky.
Yes. I spoke to close to two dozen teachers who have brands, and she was one in North Dakota. I also visited some classrooms in Michigan. And, you know, it's different with each teacher. And, one of the teachers in Michigan I interviewed was an English teacher. And he had his students read Romeo and Juliet. And then he had them rewrite it as if Romeo and Juliet were living today and were speaking to each other over instant messages or Twitter. And that really, you know, you really have to understand that Shakespeare play to be able to rewrite it in tweets. And so you can see that there's a place for technology in the classroom and that some teachers are using it to be more creative. But it also raises the question of, if a teacher has a relationship with a tech company in which they're receiving free stuff in order to promote it, and then they're going on to social media or their blogs and they're posting images or audio or video of their students using this product, and they're tagging the company in those posts, like, to what extent are they using their students to promote their own visibility and to kind of fulfill their requirements under the contract they have with this company?
Natasha Stinger is with us now, technology reporter for the New York Times business section, talking about how the tech industry has a potential right now to influence public school education. This is part of a series called Education Disrupted.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. When these teachers work as brand ambassadors, as we've been hearing, are they savvy entrepreneurs or crossing an ethical line? Are you a teacher brand ambassador yourself? What do you think of this idea of technology companies courting teachers in the way that physicians sometimes get perks from pharmaceutical companies? Or do you see this as a benefit for schools getting the free stuff, free technology that helps cash-strap schools and their students? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in a little bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're continuing our conversation right now about the influence of tech companies on public school education. Those companies are, in some cases, recruiting teachers to serve as brand ambassadors for their products. Natasha Singer stays with us. She's a New York Times technology reporter and has been writing about the impact of technology in classrooms.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea? No big deal or a big ethical gray? gray area or past gray area. Do you think teachers should be doing this? Do you think technology companies should be doing this? Should there be guidelines in place in school districts? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And we go to our callers now. We've got George with us first from Wisconsin. George, hello.
Hi there.
Hi, what did you want to share?
I teach, and we have a lot of things going on. It's not just tech companies that are doing this. There's industry in general who's trying to become schools' friends so that these kids can get sort of gleaned to working in their factories and this and that. And I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, because you do need people that are able to work in factories or businesses and everything. Mm-hmm. But it seems like it's all inclusive. So a teacher who's put in this much time and can do something for themselves isn't too much different than any of these other people that are big business, small towns. There's fab labs going on, maker spaces, there's a number of names for it.
George, can I just ask you briefly what kinds of things that, say, a local company, a factory, to use your example, might be asking of a teacher?
Well, they're actually organized as groups to help create grants for schools to get technology, things like that. Hmm. And so, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing, but they get their hands in this whole sort of concept as well.
All right, George, thank you for calling and bringing that up. Natasha, George painting a broader picture than the tech companies themselves.
No, I think that's true. And I think if we look back historically, Coca-Cola and Pepsi trying to get their machines in schools, or there were controversies when, there were scoreboards on football fields, and could cigarette companies sponsor those? So the idea of companies or industry trying to influence schools is not a new idea. What's new is with tech, because everything is online and teachers can start using an app instantly. Before there was influence in schools on administrators, and now we're talking about direct influence on individual teachers.
George, thank you. Let's go to Buck next in Sturgeon Bay. Buck, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to say?
Yeah, I don't think this is a bad thing. I mean, come on. First of all, these teachers, a lot of them aren't, they're not getting their pay scales raised up, and I'm not a teacher. I'm not in the education system, but I see how, like someone said, they got to buy their own school supplies, and then along comes a little perk for their job, and we're going to rip on them because they're going to profit a little bit for it. How many kids are they positively affecting by maybe doing this? I mean, we should be looking for every edge we can, and if a technology company has an ethical product, we just talked about soda and cigarettes. Yeah, we don't need to promote that to kids. But, if it's a good technology product, and there's a teacher with the gumption to help kids learn something new, and if he gets a little padding in his pocket, so what?
All right, Buck, thank you for your thoughts there on that. And Natasha, Buck doesn't see anything wrong with this, as teachers not getting pay raises, and also that this is helping kids ultimately. Is that sort of the prevailing thought right now?
The education community is just beginning to think about what the ramifications of this are. And, as I said earlier, we completely understand why teachers would want to get stuff for their classroom. But the problem is that the question is whether these companies are putting teachers at risk, because there are actually laws and rules in place. So in some school districts, teachers aren't allowed to accept anything of value more than $10. In other school districts, it's $50. And, there are teachers in New York who've gotten in trouble because parents bought them a computer, which was against the rules. School districts have to make decisions for themselves. And then there's also a federal law that prohibits deceptive business practices like hidden advertising. And so to avoid breaking the law, teachers, anybody who promotes something that they've been given free products or a meal or anything of value to promote, is supposed to disclose. And that would mean all these teacher ambassadors are on Twitter, every tweet pretty much ought to say ad or sponsored. Mm-hmm. And that's not going on. So one of the questions is, how does a teacher know when another teacher is recommending something, whether they truly like it or whether they like it, but they also have a company connection? So I think it's a question of transparency. I don't think the teacher's motives are in question.
Natasha, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That was Natasha Singer, technology reporter for the New York Times Business Section, taking a look at how tech firms can influence public schools.
The $3 billion financial aid package for the Foxconn Corporation could win final legislative approval tomorrow. The state assembly is scheduled to take up that measure again because of changes the state Senate made.
Meanwhile, the city of Kenosha is backing away from trying to land the project, and there are more signs that the Foxconn electronics factory would be built in Racine County. Chuck Kornbach went to the meeting, to the leading possible location, to hear about some concerns.
With birds singing and insects buzzing nearby, Melissa Warner stood yesterday along Braun Road, a couple miles east of I-94 in the village of Mount Pleasant. Warner took in the green scene.
As I'm looking around, I'm seeing cornfields, I'm hearing birds, I'm seeing a few native plants growing along the drainage canal. And I'm standing here wondering what it will be like if this is completely paved over for a factory.
Warner lives elsewhere in Racine County and is a member of the Sierra Club and two other environmental groups. She's a bit divided about Foxconn's plan to build a huge factory, quite possibly, as local officials hint, on this site.
I think Racine County needs that kind of economic impetus, and it could be a really good thing. But I am concerned about some of the environmental aspects of that that I don't think are being considered strongly enough.
Warner says those aspects include stormwater runoff from the Foxconn plant and its parking lots, leading to potential flooding in the Root River or other watersheds. She's also concerned that Governor Walker's pledge to create 2 acres of wetlands for every 1 acre destroyed won't mean new wetlands in the immediate area, and whether the Foxconn plant is built in Racine County or one of 2 rumored sites in Kenosha County. Warner says the state should not exempt Foxconn from a lengthy review called an Environmental Impact Statement, or EIS. Warner's hardly the only environmentalist making that point. At last month's legislative hearing in Racine County on the Foxconn bill, Amber Meyer-Smith of Clean Wisconsin spoke. She said the Walker administration's plan to just let the federal government do a comprehensive report would leave out a lot of key issues.
There are things that the federal government's EIS will not cover that are very specific to Wisconsin. There are things like wildlife impacts, cultural resources, land use impacts, agricultural impacts, local economic concerns.
Environmentalists are also worried about Foxconn potentially not needing state permits to dredge or fill wetlands or alter streams. Green Bay State Senator Rob Coles says environmental concerns are part of the reason he was the only Republican to vote against the Foxconn deal yesterday.
I mean, I really tried to come to a conclusion of yes on this, but there were enough uncertainties that I just could not get there.
At last month's Joint Finance Committee hearing, now acting DNR Secretary Kurt Thiede addressed concerns about the state not requiring some permits.
When we say permits, air construction permits, air operation permits, wastewater permits, runoff permits, as well as hazardous waste permits. So those are the permits that are going to remain in effect, are not modified as a result of this legislation.
Thiede's boss, Governor Scott Walker, has repeatedly promised not to lower state environmental standards. Walker also has a vision of what the Foxconn site, wherever it is, would be like, as he recently shared with the news media.
Once we break ground on this, once people see not only hiring, but they see companies around the state benefiting from the supply chain, it only get more popular every day that goes by.
So far, it's Walker's vision carrying the day at the state capitol. But unless he makes some vetoes in the legislation or changes the contract being negotiated with Foxconn, some environmental attorneys warn the debate over the company could shift to Wisconsin courtrooms. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.